very glad to welcome you all tonight to our local history night. And we have with us Professor Ross Fields, who's been with us before. And I always feel when I have a question about the 1700s in Westboro and what Parkman's interpretation was, or his feelings, I talk to Professor Fields about it. He very generously sends us for the local history room things about the young men who worked on the farms, about the women who were slavish, is that the interpretation?
The slavish work.
The slavish work that they did. And tonight we have a very interesting one about the courtship and how these young people met and how they developed their relationships and what happened. And I think we'll find it's not that different, some of it.
That's a point I'm going to raise. I think that's one of the central questions to ask.
How so, Professor Fields.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back in Westboro. It's my second home, if not geographically, at least intellectually, because I've been working with Ebenezer Parkman in the history of Westboro since the late 1970s. And people ask me, when are you going to get finished? And sometimes I get the impression, or I have the feeling, that I'm going to carry through with Parkman as many years as it took him to complete his diary. That diary he began sometime while he was a Harvard College student and kept up until almost the day of his death in 1782. So that whether this journey of mine is ever finished, I'm not quite sure. What I want to talk about this evening is a marriage. I want to talk about not the marriage in terms of what happens after the wedding day, but rather talk about the marriage as it takes place in the context of the courtship. Particularly to talk about the second marriage of Ebenezer Parkman, which took place in 1737. It's about courtship, but it's also about something larger than courtship, and I think more complex than courtship. This was Parkman's second marriage, and it took place not terribly long, about a year and a half after the death of his first wife. And what is going on in this period between 1736, when his wife dies, and his remarriage in 1737 is a complex series of emotional, rational, psychological decisions that in many respects are very much jumbled up, because this man is both mourning, he's both bereaving, feeling the loss of his first wife, but at the same time, he's also looking for a second wife. He's trying to juggle the tension that I think is inherent in that particular situation. Grief at the same time that one searches for kind of re-conceptualization of who one is emotionally, a kind of reintegration of his personal life. I want to start by suggesting that, and this is to follow up on something that you said, Jackie, that there are two dangers in talking about the 18th century, two dangers that I think we frequently encounter. The first danger is to assume that the people back in the 18th century are very much like us. That is, that they had the same kind of feelings, that they had the same kind of aspirations, that they had the same kind of values. And one of the things which I want to suggest is that while in many respects we can sympathize, empathize with an Ebenezer Parkman as he goes through this process of bereavement and then courtship and remarriage, at the same time what he is doing is in many respects different, I think, than what we might do should we lose a spouse. The second thing that I want to emphasize is that we run the risk, the danger of homogenizing the colonial period. That is, we're talking about colonial New England as if it was an unchangeable and unchanging entity. And I think that we run that danger because we forget how long the colonial period was. And as we're talking in New England terms, about 150 years. That is, from the 1620s, when Plymouth Colony is founded, and this is to ignore all the previous colony settlements in New England, but from the 1620s down to the time of the Revolution, it's an enormously long period of time. To put it in another context, if we look at the distance from the Revolution to the present day, and we're still only working, at least in terms of the federal constitution, we're only working on about 201 years. And so if we take the distance from the founding of the New England colonies down to the Revolution, it's about as long as the distance from the Revolution to the present day. Now, I'm going to give you your homework at this point rather than allowing you to do it after the session. And I want to start off with that first page of the handout. This is to give you an idea of how different things may have been. What we have on this handout in the first column on the left are the days of the week. The second column is the percentages of marriages which took place in 1980 on each of those days. And then on your sheets, but not on mine, is a blank column, the percentages for Westboro, Massachusetts in the 18th century. And what I'd like to start out with is your ideas with respect to when people, which day of the week, people would be most likely to get married in the 18th century. Remember that in the 1980 data, and I assume also for 1990, more than 50% of all persons got married on Saturday. And the next highest percentage is on Friday. And it's when about 20% of the persons were married. So I ask you, when were people most likely to have been married in 18th century Westboro? Which time of the week?
Sunday.
Sunday, sir? Okay, why Sunday? Day of free from labor, an opportunity to go to the church, leisure, putting off the toil, and we know how hard people had to work in the 18th century. Let me fill in that one blank for you, if you will. On Sunday, at least according to my data from 18th century Westboro, 3.1% of the marriages took place. So
97%
wrong. So you're 97%, right. Okay.
Was that a day that they spent in church most of the day?
The Sabbath, of course, is not merely a day of rest, but it's a day of worship. And one is not supposed to work. It's a day of the spirit and not of the flesh. And so one would not get married on a Sunday. One would not celebrate in terms of all the kinds of parties that one would have, the feasting, whatever might go on. So Sunday was not a likely day to get married in the 18th century Westboro. Did I hear somebody voting for Saturday?
I'm voting for Saturday.
All right. Why Saturday?
Again, because perhaps there was a break in the routine of the daily life.
I'll give you the figure for Saturday.
It's going to be low.
1.0%.
Everybody's at home getting married.
So we've covered 2 days of the week, and we've gotten up to 4.1% of the marriages taking place on those 2 days. Yes?
I said Tuesday right from the beginning.
Okay. Why Tuesday right from the beginning?
Well, because that gave the Monday to prepare.
Okay.
And then they could batch, if you will, their jobs, so they would have some free time.
I'm liking that answer. At least it seems to have some relevance to the data. Actually, 20.1% of those marriages took place on Tuesday. And I think you're probably getting at one of the reasons why this works out this way. But now we're up to 24.2% of the marriages, and we've eliminated three of the days, and we've only got four left to work with.
Friday.
Why Friday?
The end of the work week.
Well, the work week actually ends on Saturday. Anybody else want to support Friday? Why would you support Friday? You just like to go along, or?
No, but that would be the Friday night to celebrate.
Okay.
Sandy to regroup.
Okay. Yeah. That's a very nice word.
I don't know. Just start a little.
Okay. The figure for Friday is 2.1%. I mean, 2.0%. So now we've eliminated 4 days, and we've gotten a total of 26.2%. We seem to be closing in on the right days. I mean, it's almost hit or miss at this point. I mean, it's shooting fish in a barrel or whatever the term is. Anybody else want to we've got Monday, we have Wednesday, we have Thursday left. Monday? Why Monday?
I would.
Oh, you played the lottery, I'm sure. Okay, Monday actually doesn't work out very well either. It's only 9.6%. Actually, whenever I do this, this tends to be the pattern in which people respond. I'll fill you in at this point since we only have 2 other days with which to work. Wednesday is 15.4%, and Thursday is 48.8%.
I couldn't ask it because I knew.
First of all, I have no particular explanation as to why 48.8% would be married on Thursday. I could argue that Wednesday or Tuesday would perhaps be as good a day. But what is clearly happening, I think, is that the pattern of activity is reflected in the relationship to the Sabbath. That is, the Sabbath is that day for the spirit rather than the flesh. That is the day when one does not work, one celebrates. And that does a number of things. First of all, in Ebenezer Parkman's Westboro, the Sabbath began at sundown on Saturday. And so that pretty much eliminates Saturday as the day for the wedding, because with the sundown coming at whatever time of the year, there's going to be no consummation of the marriage, presumably after sundown, if you are a good Puritan, because that's of the flesh, and also the celebration could not go past sundown. So Saturday comes off very poorly as the day for the wedding. Sunday you can't have it. Of course, since you can't work on Sunday, you can't prepare for a Monday wedding. That leaves the middle of the week, and somehow people need enough time to prepare. They need enough time if they ride to a wedding in another town. They need enough time to return home to where they live to resume that Sabbath cycle. Yes, sir. Two points on that. One is that I don't know the data for Westboro, but my impression is that most, or at least the majority of the marriages were performed by a justice of the peace rather than by Ebenezer Parkman. That is, in the 17th century, New England, marriage was strictly, or almost invariably, a civil ceremony. It wasn't until the kind of Anglicanization that takes place after the Massachusetts Charter is revoked and a new charter is granted in 1691, that ministers are empowered and begin at some regularity to perform marriages. And so the availability of a minister is probably not as crucial as it would be in today's world. But the pattern there, I think, is an interesting one, the availability of the minister. When I look through Ebenezer Parkman's diary, the day that he's most likely not to make an entry is which day? He'll have entries for Sunday. I don't know whether he writes them on Sunday, but he will almost invariably record the texts on which he preaches in the morning and in the afternoon. He'll record particular things that go on in the church, perhaps the admission of a member. Invariably, he will have somebody to dinner between the services, and he will record the identity of those persons. So that the Sundays are, in fact, quite full, because he's using the diary as a record of his ministry. And therefore, he wants to note the sermons on which he preaches. Actually, Saturday is the day when he's least likely to write in his diary. The Saturday is a day of intense preparation for the Sunday sermons. Now, the reason to take you through all of this is to raise that important question, for us as 20th century persons looking back on the 18th century, can we really assume that people will act in patterns that we would find familiar? Well, as this would, these data would show, we can't assume that they would act in patterns that we would find familiar. Once we find the pattern, can we understand it? Now, no one says, I'm going to get married on Thursday because 50% of the people are going to get married that day and it's a good day. But perhaps we can infer from what we know about the rhythms that go on in a small New England town, we can infer why people might choose a midweek wedding day rather than a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. And so the people of Westboro, at least in their choice of the day for their marriages, are acting in ways that are perhaps understandable, but quite contrary to the ways in which we would act. Second page is something which is both an intimate entry in Parkman's diary and something which is quite both sad and startling. These are the only four entries that I can find in the diary relating to the tragedy of Mercy Maynard and Mr. Mason's Essex. He reports in that October 6th, 1756 entry that there's a both joy and sadness at the Maynard household. The joy is that neighbor Nathan's wife is brought to bed and has a son. The sadness, or the tragedy, is that Mercy, likewise, and the latter has a black one, thought to be by Mr. Mason's Essex, in other words, Mr. Mason's slave named Essex. A most grievous and sore evil, God grant her repentance and her wicked companion also, and support the wounded relatives, and give to each that grace which may be sufficient for them. A couple of weeks later, Parkman goes, as he would go to any woman who had given birth to a bastard child, or any woman who had given birth to a child too soon after the date of her marriage. That is, to get her, to encourage her to repent for her sin. October 18, 1756, I visited Mr. Ebenezer Maynard, whose youngest son is sick, and made a visit to poor, miserable Mercy Maynard and find her in some penitent way, which may God please to forward and ripen.
They also make visits to the men who fathered these bastard children?
Well, there's two problems there. One is a matter of knowing the identity of the father. The other is, in fact, a gender bias. That is, the weight of the sin is more likely to be imputed to the woman than to the man. It is more, well, part of it also depends on the church relationship that the person has. If the person has been baptized into the church, if the person certainly is a communicant member, then obviously one would work with that person, because that person, in being baptized or becoming a communicant member, has placed him or herself under what they call the watching care of the church. And the watch is the disciplinary function. The care is both the spiritual nurturing as well as the nurturing in times of crisis of your home or life. Well, that's the last we see of Mercy Maynard in 1756. And we don't see her again, or at least Parkman does not record her existence for another 16 years. January 15, 1772, Notabene Captain Howard of Canada gave me some account of Mercy Maynard, who lives and has done for some years at his house. Then, a year and a half later, October 21st, 1774, 2.5 years later, October 21st, 1774, Mr. Howard of Canada in Windham, who has been a kind friend to unhappy Mercy Maynard, called here to see me. And that is all we know about that particular tragedy. We know nothing about Essex, black slave who evidently fathered the child. We don't know what happened to the child. Did the child die? Was the child baptized? It was not baptized. There's no record in the church records. Was it sold into slavery? Did it itself become a slave? What happened to the child? Did it go with Mercy Maynard to Canada Parish of Windham? Clearly what's happened to, from Parkman's language in 1774, unhappy Mercy Maynard, she still bears the stigma of having given birth to not so much to a bastard child, but more importantly, to a black bastard child. And that is probably where the stigma lies more concretely. Now, why include that in a discussion of Ebenezer Parkman's courtship of Hannah Brett? Really, this is to remind you of the importance of Ebenezer Parkman's diary. Because rarely do we get an insight into some of the very important values that make a culture operate. And so, for all we would know, there's a record of Mercy Maynard's birth back in 1725, but for all we know, she died, if you look at the public record, she died young, and her death was not recorded, as many deaths were not recorded. So she is resurrected momentarily in Parkman's diary, and then disappears into the oblivion of someone else's household, there presumably living out her life as a spinster, as a servant, as a disgraced person. But we do get some insight into the culture and into its values through the Parkman diary. Now, on the next page, I've given you some data which suggests something both about courtship behavior in the colonial period, and also about the wider problem of the extent to which things change over time. What a number of historians have done is to go back to the vital records for places like Westboro or Holden, where I live, or scores of other towns in New England, and they've done some sort of demographic peeping into bedroom windows. What they've done is gone to the record of a marriage, and then they have looked for the birth of the first child. And they've done some simple mathematical calculations to find out how soon that first child was born. And the results of those data, aggregated from a number of towns, are shown in this particular table, showing by three lines the number of children born within 9 months of a marriage, the number of children born within 8.5 months, and the number of children born within 6 months. Now, in the New England churches, and in Westboro included among them, there was a rule of thumb. The rule of thumb was 7 months. That is, if a child was born 7 months or later after the marriage, that is, in that 7 to 9 month period, in a judgment of charity, the couple was regarded as having given birth to a premature child. If it was earlier than 7 months, it was regarded almost without saying as evidence of fornication, that is, sexual intercourse before marriage. Now, what these data show is that there is a remarkable revolution in private morality which becomes very public in the context of the 18th century. That revolution takes place over the course of the 18th century, so that by the time of the American Revolution, but not caused by the American Revolution, by the time of the American Revolution, perhaps as many as 30 or 35% of all brides are pregnant prior to the marriage ceremony. In other words, if we go back into the 17th century, we find a very puritanical society in which either the discipline or the instilled self-control of young people keeps them within the bounds of prescribed morals. By the middle of the 18th century, by the third quarter of the 18th century, clearly the old values have changed. Whatever surveillance parents and ministers and townspeople in general exercise over young people is no longer as effective, or if it is still there, the biological urges or the conception of relationships between men and women have changed. And so the stigma that might have been attached to fornication, that is a violation of the Seventh Commandment in the 17th century, is no longer such a stigma by the end of the 18th century. And then, of course, what we get is that remarkable downswing into the 19th century, where apparently people clean up their act. That is, they become more appropriate. They become not puritanical, but Victorian. In other words, our notions of the great characterizations of these periods, the Puritan age, the age of enlightenment, and then the Victorian era, seem somehow to follow these cycles out and to suggest that at the very roots of society, not up among intellectuals, not the John Cottons or the Cotton Mathers, not the Rousseaus, not the great moralists of the Victorian age, but down at the base of society, people like you and me are making very private decisions. We're making them not necessarily in lockstep, but what's happening is that the private decision that I make is being duplicated or replicated by the private decisions of many other people. And so this is to remind us that things change over time, and that what we call the colonial period, at least insofar as these data speak to the colonial period, really is a very complex era that experiences a great deal of change. And that leads me not to the next page of the handout, but rather into my talk, and I'll get to the next couple of pages in a few minutes. First of all, some background on Ebenezer Parker, that is, the public life of the man. By public life, I mean the kinds of things that you or I would have known had we been residents of Westboro, the kinds of things that we would have observed about his comings and goings, the kinds of knowledge that we would have because the birth of his children would be recorded in the vital records, with one exception, that all of the kinds of things that we have also as public lives, things like the graduation from high school or college, our own marriages, the purchase of a house, that kind of activity. Parkman was born in Boston in 1703, and as if you've had occasion to read the early portions of the published diary, coming out to Westboro was really coming out into the wilderness, and his first wife deeply regretted her isolation out in this very inhospitable area. And thus, rattlesnakes were part of the Westboro scene. Bears were hunted and killed in Westboro. Indians would come into town, hopefully friendly, but Mrs. Parkman, the first Mrs. Parkman, can recall meeting an Indian and being apparently utterly terrified. Parkman grew up in a very pious family. He was the youngest son in that family. His father was a shipwright, that is, a man who worked with his hand, had no pretensions to education, but was, in fact, a pious individual. Apparently, young Ebenezer was talented, and like, I suppose, many youngest sons, he was destined to be a kind of tithe of his parents for the church. He went to North Latin School, did well enough there to gain entrance to Harvard College, graduated in 1721. Between his graduation in 1721 and his ordination as minister of Westboro, like many other young men who were destined for the ministry, he taught school for a time, he preached where occasion or need warranted. There's some evidence that he spent some time on Nantucket during this particular period. He tried out in a number of pulpits, that is, giving what would amount to dry run sermons, and he would preach the same sermon in several towns by wasting good effort if it was reasonably well accepted. He tried out in a number of towns, finally came out to Westboro, and through a series of negotiations was called and ordained in 1724. He was also married in 1724 prior to his ordination at the age of 21. For the next 58 years, and remember this is a time when people did not retire unless they had extraordinary wealth, for the next 58 years, Parkman served as this town's minister. He successfully weathered the discords of the Great Awakening, the Great Revivals of the 1740s, in which he was what we could call a moderate New Light, that is, he was in favor of the revivals, but cautioned against the extremes of the revivals. He successfully weathered the trauma of the American Revolution, and at best we can call him a mild or moderate Whig. He was certainly no firebrand when it came to politics. He served for many years as clerk or secretary of the Marlborough Association of Ministers, a regional association, a professional association of men in the various neighboring towns. He likewise served on ecclesiastical councils, for example, when a new minister was to be ordained or if, unfortunately, an old minister was to be severed from his connection with a standing church. He served in a variety of capacities having to do with the discipline that churches would mete out to both parishioners and to their officers. His greatest renown, perhaps, came in 1761 when he was invited to preach what was called the Convention Sermon in Boston. On an annual basis, all the ministers who could make it into Boston would meet there in grand convention, and one man was elected to preach the following year's sermon. And that sermon in 1761 was one of only two of his sermons which were published during his life. And thus we could say that by education, Harvard graduate, by calling, ministry, and by sustained and dedicated effort, this was a man who was hardly a common individual. That is, he stood above the mass of his contemporaries, if one has to somehow place people in a hierarchy of education and accomplishment. Yet, at the same time, when we look back at Ebenezer Parkman, he's hardly an exceptional man. That is, he moved on the periphery of the great events. Yes, he witnessed the Great Awakening. He corresponded with Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards preached in Westboro. But Parkman's name is only loosely connected with that great series of revivals in the early 1740s. Similarly, he was at best a mild Whig during the Revolution. And we can't attach his name to any particular event or any particular pronouncement that would come either from the Loyalists or from the Whigs or patriots of his generation. In other words, he was a man, like most of us, who was witness to great events rather than active participant or cause of great events. But of course, we...